Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Senate Community and Regional Affairs Committee to order. Let the record reflect it as 1:31 p.m. on Thursday, March 19th, 2026. Present today are Senator Dunbar, Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Yunt, and myself, Senator Merrick. We have four agenda items this afternoon. First is our continued consideration of Senate Bill 247, Generated Obscene Child Sex Abuse Material by Senator Keel. We heard an introduction of this bill on Tuesday and heard invited testimony. Are there any opening comments from the sponsor, Senator Keel?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Community and Regional Affairs Committee. In respect for the committee's time, for your record, I am Jesse Keel. I have the privilege of serving Senate District B, Northern Southeast Alaska. And just as a reminder, or for those in the public who weren't at the prior hearing, this bill criminalizes the possession or the distribution of generated child sexual abuse material, and we match those up as closely as possible to the existing crimes of possessing or generating child sexual abuse material made by abusing an actual and identifiable child. And we did that as well throughout the punishment sections of the bill.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions for the bill sponsor before we move to public testimony? Okay, I will open public testimony on Senate Bill 247. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify? Welcome. Please come forward, place yourself on the record, and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Laurie Morton. I'm the Deputy Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. We support Senate Bill 247 and thank Senator Keel for sponsoring the bill. Thank y'all for listening to it. We ask for its passage from committee and that members would consider co-sponsoring the legislation. Artificial intelligence image generation models are used to create child sexual abuse material in several ways. Some AI-generated imagery depicts children who do not exist in real life. Another type of AI-generated child sexual abuse material involves real, identifiable children, such as a child known to the person who generated the image, famous children, or known abuse victims from existing child sexual abuse material series. There already is child sexual abuse material series. AI tools are used to modify a benign image of the child to appear as though the child is engaged in sexually explicit conduct. Even when AI creates an entirely fictitious child, the material still fuels and normalizes the sexualization of children. It reinforces the same patterns that drive demand for child sexual abuse material and increases risk for real-world abuse. Offenders frequently move from fantasy material to seeking authentic images. Access to virtual or non-contact abuse material has not reduced demand for real content. It often fuels it, according to studies done with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Offenders can use generated artificial intelligence to create explicit images of a child that are used as blackmail for additional sexual content, to coerce a child to engage in sexual activity, or to obtain money. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children has seen cases in which the child refuses to send a nude image to the offender, and the offender then creates an explicit generated AI image of that child and then uses that as blackmail to get more images. When images are passed around a school community or peer groups, the victim may be bullied, teased, or harassed. Some cases lead to self-harm or suicides. Offenders must be held accountable for this horrendous abuse. Senate Bill 247 is the first step in making that happen. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that testimony. I see no questions from the committee. Is there anyone else in the room wishing to testify? Is there anyone online? Seeing no one, I will close public testimony. Next, I would like to invite Angie Kemp with the Department of Law to the table and to express any concerns or suggestions that law has with this bill. Thank you for being here, Ms. Kemp.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Again, for the record, Deputy Attorney General Angie Kemp with the Criminal Division. The issue that we raised with the sponsor of the bill, and just want to point out and appreciate working with the sponsor of the bill to help fix some of these issues potentially, is that right now, as drafted, the current version of generated CSAM does not have a registration, a sexual offender registration component. What we're asking for is that the committee includes registration just as it does with CSAM in general. So right now, under current law for child sex abuse material, it is a registrable offense under the law. What we're asking for the sponsor to and the committee to endorse is adding generated CSAM as a registrable offense as well. There's a few things, explanations for that. When we think of generated CSAM, I think it's maybe important to think of what detectives are coming across practically in the course of these investigations. This is, right now, the way that a typical, I'll say, child sex abuse material case is investigated, is we review, law enforcement typically gets tips or has other reasons why they believe that there is child sex abuse material. And they use a computer program to look for known hash values. And when I say known hash values, I'm talking about images and videos that are known and have been previously identified as actual children, because under current law, that's what's required to the state to prove. So there's a software that's used to identify known children or known hash values, I'll say. And what investigators are finding is that as they're looking for evidence of the known hash values, what they're seeing is a whole boatload of other, what they perceive right now to potentially be produced through artificial intelligence images and videos. Mostly images is what I'm told we're coming across. I think that as technology increases, you'll start to see more instances where videos are become, I'll say, better. It's weird to use that word in this context, but technology is improving so fast. So right now, if you create a structure, just practically speaking, where you have that dynamic at play, it creates an incentive to want to litigate fairly heavily whether an actual child is used. Historically, as you can imagine, the prosecution could show, unfortunately, a video or image to a juror, and an officer could testify fairly easily and describe that this appears to be a child. Now, I think, given how quickly technology is advancing, we're not going to have that luxury anymore. And luxury, I mean, there's going to be more likely inherent disputes about whether it's an actual child being depicted. So then you'll be practically left with the scenario of, do we insist that both defendants or the defendant register for both offenses, or is there a categorical difference between someone who is sitting in their home asking artificial intelligence to create digital images of this conduct, or versus the situation where they're asking for it and receiving it from outside sources typically. So the Department of Law's perspective is the concern that this may create a perverse dynamic that may affect our ability to obtain convictions when actual children are being used. I want to say one thing about just artificial intelligence in general. The actual children, artificial intelligence learns off of images of existing children, for example. So it learns, it's using existing images or videos to learn and train itself. So I'm trying to be careful because I don't want to suggest that actual children aren't being used by artificial intelligence to create these models. But when I'm talking about actual children, I'm talking about children that typically have been identified through the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and we know have been previously victimized, and their images and videos are being circulated online.
Thank you, Ms. Kemp. Questions from committee members? Seeing none, I'm in agreement with you, Ms. Kemp, on this, and so we will be working on a committee substitute with the sponsor. I see no questions from the committee, so thank you for being here.
Thanks.
There is a House companion of this legislation, which is also in this committee. It's my intention to hear the differences between this and HB 47 and pass the two bills to their next committee, which is Judiciary, together. So for now, we will set Senate Bill 247 aside, and we will bring up Senator Keel for Senate Bill 258, Contracts, Licensing Software Applications. We heard an introduction of this bill on Tuesday, and Senator, welcome back to the committee. If you'd like to put yourself on the record and introduce your bill again.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the Community and Regional Affairs Committee. For your records, I am Jesse Keel, Senator for Senate District B, Northern Southeast Alaska. I should pause and just say I look forward to working with you and the Department of Law. We've had some good conversations. That'll be a good committee substitute. On this bill, Senate Bill 258 is the Fair Software Licensing Bill. And to refresh the committee on what it does, it puts the state government or a local government in Alaska in control of where it runs software licenses that the government has procured and prevents vendor lock-in that would dictate to a public entity what cloud it can operate, what servers it can operate, what machines it can operate software on that the entity owns, so that public procurement of software, so important to providing public services efficiently and cost-effectively, can be decided based on quality, based on security, based on all the things that we would want our public entities to consider when they buy anything. So by putting that control in the public entity's hand, we ensure accountability to the citizens and cost effectiveness for the budget.
Thank you. Senator Young.
Thank you, through the chair, to Senator Keel. Wouldn't that be disclosed up front? And could you please maybe provide like a real life example? So I'm not exactly Mr. Technology here, but wouldn't those details be disclosed up front before the purchase of said software program?
So through the chair, Madam Chair, to answer Senator Yunt's question, I can think of a couple of maybe examples. One would be a software company that in order to continue providing support for software licenses that a government entity might be running on local computers, on-premises servers or on desktop machines, requires that that be upgraded to a cloud-based product in advance. the local government bought the licenses. Along with that came the right to run them where they chose. But now, as a condition of continuing support, there's a requirement that they be moved. So that's one thing. The other might be The other might be a situation in which a software company will not allow a government entity to run its software in any other or specific other competitors' cloud environments. And so if there's a great smoke and package deal and your local government says, got to take that, it meets all our requirements and it costs less, this bill leaves them the option. But if, in fact, they can get the license from the software company and then run it more cost-effectively in another cloud environment or with better security in a better cloud environment or pick your criterion, this bill leaves open to that local government or to the state of Alaska the right to do so.
Thank you.
Thank you. I see nothing further, so we will move to invited testimony. On Teams, we have Scott Drexel, State Policy Director with the Coalition for Fair Software Licensing. Welcome to the committee. If you could please place yourself on the record, your name, affiliation, and location, and begin your testimony.
Hi. Well, thank you again to the senator for, first of all, bringing this important bill, and thank you to the chair and to the committee for being willing to hear it. My name is Scott Drexel. I'm here on behalf of a an organization called the Coalition for Fair Software Licensing. I happen to be sitting in Phoenix, Arizona at the moment, where I believe it's a little bit warmer than it is there in town. I'd hoped to be able to make it up in person, so I appreciate the accommodation and being able to do this online. As I said, the Coalition for Fair Software Licensing that I'm here on behalf of, it's an organization that's comprised of American companies and nonprofits representing a cross-section of industries from healthcare and financial services, manufacturing, software and cloud and cybersecurity providers. So the purpose of this bill is really very simple. It's to ensure that a contract entered into by a state agency for the purchase of software that's designed to run on generally available server hardware doesn't artificially restrict the state's ability to deploy that software in the infrastructure environment that best fits its particular business needs. The need for this legislation arises out of a growing concern over the past 6 to 7 years among IT leaders, procurement offices, and regulators around the country that restrictive licensing practices tend to lead to wasteful spending, unnecessary cybersecurity vulnerabilities, and a hindrance of technology modernization efforts across the board. These restrictive licensing practices also lead to what we call vendor lock, and it's when purchasers of software are effectively prevented from switching between technology service providers as circumstances necessitate, and they may necessitate it for different reasons, cybersecurity, cost, but the purchaser of those software products, in this case a public entity, is effectively locked into goods and services above and beyond what it needs, or an inability to procure new goods and services because of sort of terms that are buried deep in the contract purchase. So prior to 2019, the prevailing industry practice was known as BYOL, which is sort of a bring your own license. And under that policy, the customer who purchased the software was free to deploy that software in whatever environment best met its business needs. And the policy is a good one because it encourages greater interoperability and vendor diversification, which is actually really pretty critical for cyber resilience. Because you know, anytime you're siloing with a single vendor of software products or services, a vulnerability in one very quickly becomes a vulnerability in all of them. There were several large legacy software providers that instituted a modification to their licensing terms out of no technical necessity, really just sort of a means of leveraging the fact that people liked their software products and to force them into buying additional goods and services in the form of cloud services. And so what it did is it restricted the number of vendors that public agencies could use. It leads to increased cost. And it really specifically targets their competitors rather than any kind of benefit to the customer. And so this issue's gained quite a bit of attention at the federal level, certainly. There's an active Federal Trade Commission investigation that was started under the Biden administration. I believe this is probably one of the few things you could say this about, was carried over into the Trump administration and is ongoing today. The House of Representatives, for the second time this past December, passed a piece of legislation called the Strengthening Agency Management and Oversight of Software Assets Act, really aimed at this particular issue. The National Defense Authorization Act ordered an audit of these software licenses to ensure that they have an adequate process for understanding where they are locked into to different agreements. There's a GAO report from just last year identifying almost $1 billion in savings at the federal level just simply by making these licenses a bit more portable between offices. The Council of State Governments has adopted this very language into model language across the country. This is Alaska would be the seventh state to pass this legislation, in addition to Colorado, Missouri, Illinois, Indiana, New Hampshire, Ohio. And it's actually currently on the desk of the governor of West Virginia and being considered by about another dozen states this year, really because it's a software and technology procurement Good Housekeeping Act. It doesn't, it's completely nonpartisan. It doesn't ask the state to pick winners and losers between, you know, contracts or vendors. It really doesn't ask the state to do anything at all. It simply decouples this idea of purchasing software for how that software is deployed, so that you don't have a situation where the tail's kind of wagging the dog and the vendor is dictating to the customer, the state or the public agency, how they're using these products that they've already purchased. It's also been endorsed by my organization, the Coalition for Fair Software Licensing, CCIA, the Computer Communications Industry Association, Alliance for Digital Innovation, NetChoice, and I could go on and on. But I'll stop there out of respect for the committee's time, and I very much appreciate your willingness to have me on virtually today.
Thank you so much. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Drexel. We appreciate you being here today. With that, I'm going to open public testimony. Thank you. Open public testimony on Senate Bill 258. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify? Is there anyone online? Seeing none, we will close public testimony. Are there any questions or comments from committee members before we look to the will of the committee? Seeing none, Senator Dunbar.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 258, version 34-Lima-Sierra-1172/November from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying zero fiscal note, and authorize Legislative Legal Services to make conforming changes.
Thank you. Is there an objection? Hearing none, Senate Bill 258 is moved from committee. We'll take it at ease. I call the committee back to order at 1:54 p.m. Next is an introduction of Senate Bill 268, Sick Leave Exemption Fish Processors by President Stevens. Welcome to the committee, Mr. President. If you and your staff, Tim Lamkin, would like to place yourselves on the record and proceed with your introduction of the bill.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing the bill. Senator Gary Stevens, Kodiak. This bill is... as you recall, I'm back up a little bit. As you recall, in 2024, the voters of Alaska approved a ballot measure number one, and that included provisions for sick leave. But the problem is that they also recognize there are some industries that have special difficulties. They have unique seasons and operational economic conditions, and some specific exemptions in that ballot measure number one were created for fishermen, for shrimp processors, for aquaculture workers, and for agricultural workers. And those exemptions, Madam Secretary, were not accidental. They recognized the realities of some of our industries. And seafood processing is certainly, as you well know, a seasonal industry. It's based on availability of resources. It's based on conditions of weather, and often seafood processing exists in remote areas which have particular problems with workforce housing, with transportation, compress schedules. And that all represents really some unique challenges that this industry faces. So the employment in this sector, in the fishing industry, is frequently short and intensive windows of operation, fundamentally different from most jobs, from most year-round employment models. So this bill does not seek to overturn the will of the voters, not at all. It addresses the unintended consequences that recognizes the interdependence between fishermen and seafood processors. So thank you, Madam Chair, for considering the operational realities of this industry, a very important industry, Alaska seafood industry, to our state. And we have several people who would like to speak to you about that, and they can answer some very any specific questions you may have on what the industry is like. Thank you.
Thank you, President Stevens. Any questions before invited testimony? Seeing none, we have four invited testifiers this afternoon. First on the phone is Julie Decker, president of the Pacific Seafood Processors Association. Welcome, Ms. Decker. If you could please state your name, your location, and affiliation for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Julie Decker. I'm the president of the Pacific Seafood Processors Association, and I live in Wrangell. PSPA is a trade association which represents seafood processors with 50 facilities across 22 coastal communities in Alaska. PSPA companies buy fish from thousands of independent commercial fishermen across the state and in almost every fishery. The health of the seafood industry is critical to Alaska as it generates $6 billion in economic activity in Alaska annually. It creates 42,000 direct jobs, of which those are approximately 50% processing worker jobs and 50% fishermen jobs, and is the state's largest manufacturing and export sector, and also lowers the cost of transportation for all Alaskans. Alaska's seafood processing sector operates under uniquely challenging conditions. Processing facilities are often located in highly remote environments where workforce availability, housing, transportation, operational continuity, and servicing of commercial fishermen are tightly interconnected. These realities require policies that are carefully tailored to the industry's structure while still supporting the health and well-being of employees. Senate Bill 268 provides a balanced approach to that. It recognizes the intent of the voter-approved paid sick leave initiative while also addressing the distinct nature of seafood processing operations and connection to commercial fishermen. In the original language of the ballot measure, an exemption was made to the mandatory paid sick leave section for fishermen, agriculture and aquaculture workers, and even shrimp hand pickers or processors. By aligning seafood processors more closely with the exemptions already provided by law, this legislation recognizes the interconnected nature of fishermen and processors in the Alaska seafood industry and ensures commercial fishermen will continue to get uninterrupted services and greater consistency of application across similarly situated industries. Importantly, SB 268 supports workforce stability and operational planning in an industry that already includes very high risk and unpredictability of wild fisheries. Predictable and workable leave policies help employers maintain safe, efficient operations while continuing to provide thousands of jobs and purchase fish in an efficient manner from thousands of commercial fishermen, maintaining high quality and value and keeping fishermen fishing. I'd like to add one more thing in response to one of the public letters submitted. This exemption that we're asking for is really not about whether workers should be provided paid sick leave. We're not in opposition to that. However, the details of ballot measure one, there's three details that work together to create some unintended consequences. So I'll outline those. The first one is the accrual of paid sick leave over time. You can accrue up to 7 work days of paid sick leave. The second, in combination of the use it or lose it provision. And the third is the very limited and in reality no ability for employers to enforce whether people are taking sick leave because they're actually sick or not. Those three things in combination create what we believe is an unintended consequence of the ballot measure to sort of incentivize employees, particularly seasonal employees, to hold that sick leave to the end and use it. That is the problem. That's the real challenge for us operationally, and that is really why you see this bill in front of you today. So that's the end of my testimony, and I'll stay online if there's any questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Decker. I see no questions.
I'm sorry,
Senator Dunbar.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I have a few questions, Ms. Decker, and these questions I'll probably repeat to the processors, the other folks that are online. You partially answered my question with what exactly it was the ballot measure required. So accrual over time, use it or lose it, and you could sort of cash it out at the end. I don't want to presume things, but I think I'm probably one of the few people in the legislature that actually worked on the slime line in a seafood processor a couple of times, and also worked as a commercial fisherman. Whereas the commercial fishing, I understand, you have these openers in some fisheries, they're very sort of quick, maybe this enforcement, this isn't practical. When I worked at canneries, it was a typical job in the sense of, we were working 15 hours a day, but it was predictable. It was every day. They brought in fish from a variety of different either openers or sometimes even different fisheries, and the fish processor was working all the time. And so even though it was seasonal, it was still for that season fairly typical, not 9 to 5, 7 to 11 or whatever it was job. So my question is, in that set of circumstances, isn't there a differentiation between folks that work in these processing plants and people that work on the ships? Also, fish processing, there's a lot of different kinds of fish processing, right? You have floating processors. Maybe that's different than onshore. Maybe it's different if you have a small processor versus a large processor. But in all these cases, it does strike me that remoteness, for example, or the intensity sort of increases the need for sick leave rather than decreases it. Because if someone on that slime line got sick, we're all working shoulder to shoulder, really long hours. Sometimes it's wet and cold in some cases. And, what don't we want them to have sick leave so that we are not creating larger problems for those fish processors? So that was a few different questions, Ms. Decker, but I'm hoping you can parse what I said.
Thank you, Ms. Decker.
Thank you, through the chair. Senator Dunbar, thanks for your question. I also started out working on the line at a seafood processing facility, so recognize 100% what you're saying. I will say, again, we don't want people working when they're sick. That's not what the bill is about. The bill is about, at the end of the season, the incentive for people to accrue paid sick leave and use it all at the end could result in, let's say, 20% of your workers being gone at the end of the season, yet you still have fish coming in on a regular basis from fishermen and tenders. That is a challenge. It's not a challenge to have 1 or 2 or 3% of your workers out sick, and they're truly sick and they need sick leave. They need to be off the line. That's not the challenge. It's the challenge of the build up toward the end of the season. I hope that answered your question. If there's any others, I'll stay on the line.
Follow up,
yes, Senator Dunbar.
So I would like to hear from you, if you know Ms. Decker, and from all of the processors that are online, the sick leave that you have, is it paid sick leave? That is, someone gets sick, they have to take a couple of days off on the slime line. Are they getting paid for those days?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Dunbar. Processors that have year-round employees already had paid sick leave before ballot measure one was approved by voters. Whether sick leave is paid for seasonal workers really varies by company, so I don't know if I can answer that fully.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Yun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. through the chair to Ms. Decker or the sponsor, President Stevens or whoever made. So I think what we're really talking about here is an unvetted ballot initiative that didn't go through the committee process, that didn't take into consideration unintended consequences is what we're really talking about here. So in our small business at home, we've given out, we've done 120 hours a year, time off, sick leave, vacation, however they want to use it for well over a decade, for a long time. And so we price that into the wages. So in this situation, I think what's going to happen is in a couple of years, these employers are going to look back and they're going to say, this is the cost of doing business in the new world, and it's just going to affect wages. So then the only way to really get your money's worth out of your job is to, I don't want to say abuse, but actually take advantage of or abuse this paid sick leave, you know, and that's kind of to me what seems to be happening is they're just saving it up till the end of the year. And you know, we can wait to talk about this, but it's possibly other industries too, all forms of tourism, seasonal stuff. There's so many seasonal jobs in Alaska, lawn care, snow removal, many forms of construction. So I think what it is just unintended consequences. I support the general direction of Senate Bill 268 for sure. But, you know, and I don't know how you solve that. If we don't fix it here in the legislature, I don't know how employers solve that so that somebody can't abuse it other than just to say, we're going to price it in and we're not going to give raises on wages for the next 3 to 5 years, which I would hate to see. So, thanks.
Thank you, Senator Yant. We will move to our next testifier, Tom Enloe, with the CEO of Unisea. Welcome, Mr. Enloe. If you could state your name, location, and affiliation for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify for you today. My name is Tom Enloe, for the record. I'm the president and CEO of Unisea. Unisea is a multi-species shore-based processor that has operated in Unalaska for over 50 years, processing Bering Sea and Aleutian Island crab, cod, pollock, sable fish, and halibut. And I am located in Unalaska. I'm testifying today on behalf of Unisea in support of Senate Bill 268 relating to the minimum paid sick leave requirements for individuals employed in seafood processing. And I would like to take this opportunity to thank Senator Stevens for sponsoring the bill. I believe Senate Bill 268 clarifies the original intent in alignment with the exemptions that were already set forth in Ballot Measure 1. It does this by pointing out that seafood processing is uniquely tied to fishermen and seafood harvesting in its seasonality, resource availability, and timing, and that by adding seafood processors, as was done with shrimp processors, to the list of exempted workers, it makes it consistent with regard to the original intent that seafood industry labor is unique and is dependent on the timing of the harvest and processing to preserve the quality and value of the Alaska fish resources. Since the implementation of Ballot Measure 1, Unisea has seen a trend whereby processing employees will bank up accrued sick time and use them as days off prior to the season ending, which is a critical time for processors and fishermen as the last of the season's harvest is landed for processing. This is leading factories prove short and potentially degrading the quality of the product we're processing. Senate Bill 268 would discourage this practice and ensure the processors and full crews are available to finish up the last of the season's harvest. Again, thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm happy to stay online and take any questions.
Thank you very much. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let's see here. So I'm thinking about ways to get around this timing issue and the idea of banking the leave. Now, I think there are lots of professions that bank leave. I bank leave in the military, and I can spend it terminal leave at the end of after a deployment, that kind of thing. So I don't think it's so unusual that folks bank leave. I mean, that's done you know, a variety of places. Could you offer incentive payments so that people don't do that? You know, time and a half. I mean, I assume you already are paying some time and a half because of the kind of hours people work, but other kind of bonuses to keep people on the line. And then my second question is, do you already offer paid sick leave to seasonal workers?
Mr. Enloe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, Senator Dunbar. We provide many incentives for our workers. Our seasonal workers are oftentimes given a bonus if they complete their contract with us. They are given bonus oftentimes for helping us recruit and retain workers, so they may refer a friend or family member to come and work for us in Alaska, and they receive a bonus that way. They do get time and a half for overtime. Oftentimes, these workers will work, you know, 60 to 70 hours a week in overtime. Not in overtime, but in total hours. And the average wage at that point becomes $22 an hour. And so, you know, we think it's fine that, you know, workers should get sick pay, but what we see happening is that they're not using it for sick pay, they're using it for time off. And that's, to me, not kind of going against the spirit of the original ballot measure. You know, if a person is working for a company and they get sick time and they call in sick and they take the sick time, we would, the employer would never know if that person was actually sick or not, where we're in a closed campus where we provide housing for employees and we see people taking a sick day and are walking around campus or leaving to go out into the community and coming back. So clearly, if they're not that sick. And so we think it's an opportunity to abuse that, and we definitely are seeing situations where people are banking it and taking off. And I don't think it was intended to be a bonus day off. I think it was intended to pay workers who are actually sick. Prior to the ballot measure, we did not offer sick leave to seasonal processing workers. Our full-time year-round workers in Alaska do, of course, get vacation time and sick time and all the other benefits you'd find in employment. We don't want sick workers to come to work for sure, but we worry and concern that adding this sick leave would be good potential for abuse. I hope that answers your question, Senator.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Enloe. That was great information. I appreciate you being honest with the committee like that. If we were to pass this exemption, now Ms. Decker pointed out that there are several specific measures in the ballot initiative that, you know, having to do with use it or lose it and making it bankable, that kind of thing, that perhaps are not ideal for the industry. But if we pass this exemption, do you plan to offer paid sick leave to your seasonal employees?
We don't have any plans in place right now. It's something we would consider. I think that finding a way to be able to compensate people who are sick and to take a day off because they're sick or a couple days off because they're sick without creating a situation where they're incentivized to bank that time and take it as bonus time before they leave the finish up their contract and finish up the season and leaving. I mean, I think most companies would be willing to figure out how they could do that. So we would be open to looking at how that would happen.
Thank you, Ms. Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Enloe, and I don't want to sound like I'm picking on you. You just happened to be first. But I'm going to ask the same questions of the other folks who are going to testify, so I hope they also prepare those answers. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Enloe. We appreciate you being here. Next on Teams, we have Sinclair Will, Director of Government Affairs for Westward Seafoods. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name, location, and affiliation for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sinclair Wilt, representing Westward Seafoods. I am joining you from Anchorage. We appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of SB 268. Westward Seafoods operates three seafood processing plants in Unalaska Dutch Harbor. We process pollock, cod, crab, halibut, black cod. Many of the products we produce, especially pollock products, are commodity products. Product pricing is based on world market prices. We are competing against a country that does not have the same regulatory oversight or costs as we have. We are price takers, not price makers. The industry, as you may well be aware, has been in a very tough economic time the past few years. New mandates such as this initiative that add operating costs further hinders our ability to be competitive against our foreign competitors. As is the nature of seafood processing in Alaska, our production schedule is based on fishing seasons. We therefore employ many workers on a seasonal basis. We are of the opinion that seafood processing operations should be treated the same as commercial fishermen, agricultural workers, aquacultural workers, and even shrimp pickers, and be exempted from the sick leave section of the regulations as they are. We thank Gary Stevens in sponsoring this bill. We appreciate your consideration of SB 268 and respectfully urge your support. And to address the questions as already asked, we are also concerned about the abuse of sick leave at the end of a season when we're trying to when everyone's worn out, we're trying to finish out a season and to have employees suddenly say, well, I'll just take sick leave at this time without verifying that they're sick. They don't have to, and to just leave us shorthanded. It is a difficult position to be in.
Thank you, Mr. Wilt.
And
I have a question. If you worked the entire season, took no sick days, how many would you accrue at the end?
Well, that depends on the season and how long it gets stretched out. Typically, a pollock season is about 3 months in length. But they're usually very long days. Usually 11 and a half hours a day, 7 days a week. So lots of overtime are made. I don't have the calculations on how many hours that is, but certainly they're accruing at this rate.
Great. Thank you. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Wilt, for being here. And you partially answered my questions, but I wanted to ask. So first of all, the employees that are taking these sick leaves at the end, are they getting the same amount of pay typically on average as the folks that do go to work, or do they miss out on those overtime opportunities? That is to say, when I worked in the fish processing plant, I can't recall a single 8-hour day. I worked, you know, between 11 and 16 hours, I think, every time I worked. So are the employees that go to work making more money than the employees that take the 6-day or the sick day leave? Do they somehow get more? And my second question is, did you before the initiative have paid sick leave for seasonal employees? And if we pass this, do you plan to have a paid sick leave policy for your seasonal employees? It could look differently than the one the initiative mandated, you know, with the rollover and whatnot, but do you plan to have a paid sick leave policy for your seasonal employees?
That's a question I didn't anticipate, and I don't have an answer for you. That would be up to considerations by the management team and our new president. So I'm having difficulty answering that one, but certainly we want to take care of them. We want to treat our seasonal workers well because we want them to come back for the next season. We want to see them put themselves into position for promotion to better jobs and full-time jobs that we have available. So we want to provide them a good experience and the opportunity to succeed and progress.
Follow, Madam Chair.
Senator Dunbar.
First, I'll say I can see you on Teams. You're wearing a Copper River fleece. I grew up in Cordova, so I appreciate that, one of our favorite companies. The question I asked initially was the folks that take these sick days at the end of the season, do they typically make less money on those days than the people that do go into work and potentially get overtime?
If they were just collecting sick pay, I don't think that's a – certainly that wouldn't be the same as someone that's putting in an 11, 12-hour day with overtime.
Thank you.
So there is a difference.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Yunt.
Thank you. Through the chair, can I ask that question in a little bit different form? When somebody takes a paid sick day off, are they – only getting 8 hours on their paycheck, let's assume at the end of the season they've got 21 hours banked and they take the next 3 days in a row off, would they get 8 hours on day one, 8 hours on day two, and 5 hours on day three, or would they get the same shift hours that everybody worked on day one? So let's say that's 12, and then on day two, nine. And the reason I ask is it makes a big difference when it comes down to overtime. I believe they're only going to get 8, 8, 5. They're not going to get 12 and 9, so they're not going to get overtime out of paid sick leave, but I think that would help answer the question. Thank you.
Mr. Will.
I believe it would be on a straight time basis, but I don't know that I can answer that any better, but I believe it's just on the straight time basis.
Great. Thank you very much. We appreciate you being here. We will move to our final testifier this afternoon, Megan O'Neill, Director of Government Affairs with CanFisco. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name, affiliation, location, and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Merrick and Senate Community and Regional Affairs members. My name is Megan O'Neill. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for CanFisco Group. I live in Petersburg, Alaska, and I'm calling in from Anchorage today. I'm testifying today in support of Senate Bill 268 to exempt seasonal seafood workers from paid sick leave. CanFisco Group comprises several seafood processing companies united by common ownership and purpose. These include Alaska General Seafoods, Leader Creek Fisheries, E&E Foods, and North Pacific Seafoods, operating 11 seafood processing plants located in the communities of Togiak, Naknek, Igigik, Kenai, Kodiak, Yakutat, Siksat, and Ketchikan, employing 900 full-time staff and 4,000 workers total during our peak each summer. We support 1,750 small businesses in Alaska through our purchases of seafood from individual fishermen. Three of our processing plants operate year-round or nearly year-round. These are in Kenai, Kodiak, and Sitka. Many employees at these locations are resident full-time employees that would not be impacted by this bill or lose any of their benefits. We support the bill for our seasonal processing plants that operate for only a few months during the salmon runs each summer. These seasonal workers are provided with different benefits, including transportation, meals, and housing. They earn hourly pay that is a minimum of 38% above Alaska's minimum wage and benefit from significant overtime pay during the peak of the salmon season. This opportunity is what draws these workers to apply for our seasonal jobs. Applying paid sick leave benefits to these workers is disruptive to our operations dependent on having a sufficient number of workers in place to receive deliveries from fishermen, process fish quickly to enable our fishermen to return to fishing, and produce high-quality food. No matter the intent, requiring paid sick leave creates an incentive for workers to use it as paid time off towards the end of the summer fishing season when we still need workers to process fish. We have no way to mitigate the situation right now. Our seasonal facilities don't have the housing capacity to accommodate overhiring, and there is no additional housing available in these remote areas. This is not uncommon in small coastal communities. Like our fishermen counterparts who are exempted from paid sick leave requirements under ballot measure one, our seafood processing jobs are rewarding for those committed to long work hours during the peak seasons through generous overtime. We offer rich benefits for all employees, including low-cost, comprehensive medical, dental, vision, and prescription benefits, life insurance, and a retirement plan that allows employees to participate from their first hour of employment. Thank you for hearing this bill and the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Ms. O'Neill. I'll ask you the same question. In a normal season, how much sick time would someone accrue?
Up to 1 week. If it's a very short salmon season, they may not accrue enough hours to reach 1 week. But in a typical salmon season, I would expect them to reach 1 week.
Thank you. That's helpful. Senator Yunt.
Thank you, through the chair. How long is the typical salmon season? That way we can back our way into some calculations here.
Through the chair, typical salmon season for us, salmon starts out in Bristol Bay, and it starts beginning of June and goes till about the middle of August. And then those plants start shutting down for the year. We do have other plants throughout the state, and when workers want to continue to work, they have opportunities to move to these plants as you head east through Alaska and continue working for us if they want to.
Senator Yunt.
Thank you. Follow-up would be, do the same question I asked earlier, paid sick leave, would you do it 8 hours a day until they're out of hours, or if they'd been working, say, 12-hour shifts or 14-hour shifts, would you do a 12 and a, you know, couple 12s and until it was gone? So thanks.
Through the chair, I can talk to HR and follow up with the answer. It wasn't a question I expected.
Thank you. If you do that, we will distribute it to the committee. Senator Dunbar.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for testifying, Ms. O'Neill. I'm asking you the same questions I asked the prior testifiers. Before the ballot initiative, did you offer paid sick leave to your seasonal employees? And if this passes and we exempt from the requirements of the ballot initiative, which have specific things about rollover and accrual and that kind of thing, if you're exempt from those, will you craft or offer any alternative sick leave program to your seasonal employees?
Through the chair, Senator, before ballot measure one, we had paid time off for full-time employees, and we still do, so this provided a form of paid sick leave. We didn't offer it to seasonal workers, and how we would deal with if there was an opportunity to change how it was accrued isn't something that we've talked about within our company yet, but I'm certain that we will moving forward. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We appreciate you testifying, Ms. O'Neill. Thank you for being here. That is the remainder of our public test or our invited testimony. Would you have any closing comments, Mr. President?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gary Stevens, Senator Gary Stevens, Kodiak. Well, I think I've really learned a lot from the invited testimony. My experience in the fishing industry is probably not as extensive, but for 5 years I managed a family processing plant, and we felt some of the same problems where you have to bring people up, fly them up, you pay for the transportation, you have limited housing for them, you have a lot of issues trying to make sure people are available when you need them, and if suddenly people leave at the end of season, it causes enormous problems. No one is trying to say people have to work when they're sick. That's not it at all. We need to honor that, certainly. But the problem is at the end of the season where there seems to be an enormous overuse, and I'm not sure what the answer is to that. I think the answer is to treat the fishing industry the same way we treat the other folks who were exempted from the original ballot measure.
Thank you. Senator Yunt.
Thank you through the chair to President Stevens. First of all, I just want to say thank you for bringing this forward. Again, I'll say earlier, I'm not trying to speak negatively on the ballot initiative. What I will say is they all start out well-intentioned, but they also don't get vetted. and it'll go through committees in the legislature, and so then you can wind up with situations like this. And so we have two senators in the room with an extensive amount of time in the fishing industry, and so I'm glad to see this is coming forward, but I think many people, small business owners in the tourism industry, would say the same thing, that they're struggling with this. In fact, I know that of some seasonal restaurants. I don't want to say seasonal, but the ones that have to hire seasonal employees from out of state and out of country who come up to help get them through the busy season. Lawn care companies that only work, you know, maybe 16 weeks a year, snowplow contractor, so on and so forth. So would you be open to this committee potentially coming up with a committee substitute in the future to help take care of other industries?
Senator Gary Stevens, Kodak, certainly, Senator Yount, be willing to consider any conditions you may want to talk about.
Thank you very much. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's funny. I have the same sense of what Senator Yount does, or I say the senator from Wasilla, but it cuts in the exact opposite way for me. That is to say, I'm worried about many industries coming, asking for an exemption until eventually the ballot measure has no real impact. And we're back to where we were before, where so many employees in the state are not covered by paid sick leave. What's persuasive to me is when there are really unique characteristics of an industry. And so working on a fishing boat, that makes sense to me because of the way openers work. You know, it's not like a 9-to-5 job. I don't know that that is the case with most processors, because as the testifiers here said, they use multiple species to keep the processors open longer and continually through a season, or in some cases year round. And so I'm hesitant to carve out a special exemption for what look like very intensive, if even short-term, employees. That being said, what I have learned at this session, at this hearing, is the accrual provisions might be particularly challenging. That is, they accrue to the end of the season. I've experienced the end of a fishing season before. I know it can get hectic, and maybe there is some way we can limit this. And so I'm not saying we have to resolve this today, but a thought about, is it possible to exempt from a portion of the ballot initiative, but not the entire initiative? That is to say, I think folks mostly don't want their employees working when they're sick. I feel strongly that people should have paid time off. All of these things have to be sort of negotiated within our policy space. But the accrual provision might be particularly challenging for FIS processors. And so maybe there is a way to limit the exemption to just that provision. Just an idea to float out there. That's all, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar. This committee has some work to do on your bill, Mr. President. We will have some conversations and work with your office moving forward. Any other closing comments?
No, thank you so much for hearing, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you so much. Our final agenda item is Senate Bill 153, Public Meetings, Exempt Muni Service Area Boards, by our own Senator Yount. Senator, if you and your staff, Ryan McKee, would place yourself on the record and proceed with your bill introduction.
Thank you. For the record, Senator Yount from Wasilla, Meadow Lakes, North Lakes area, and my chief of staff, Ryan McKee. Grab a hold of this here. So, let's see. Senate Bill 153 would exempt municipal service area boards from the requirements of the Alaska Open Meetings Act. Across Alaska, municipalities often establish service areas to provide localized services such as road maintenance, fire protection, or parks. These service areas are typically overseen by small volunteer advisory boards made up of residents who provide recommendations to the governing assembly or council. These boards are not legislative bodies and do not exercise any final decision-making authority. Instead, they serve in an advisory capacity to the municipality. Despite their limited role, service boards are often treated as though they are subject to the full requirements of the Open Meetings Act. This can create unnecessary administrative burdens for small volunteer boards, particularly in rural communities where staffing and resources are limited. SB 153 recognizes the advisory nature of the municipal service area boards and removes them from the Open Meetings Act requirements. The legislation does not reduce transparency in municipal decision making. Final decisions about service area budgets, policies, and authorities remain with the municipal assembly or council, which will continue to meet in full compliance with the OMA. By right-sizing these requirements, the bill supports volunteer participation, reduces administrative burdens on municipalities, and ensures that local advisory boards can focus on serving their communities. And I think it'd be appropriate for me to give a real-life example. So our Mat-Su borough is the size of West Virginia. We have, I believe, 16 road service areas in our community. Some are very, very large areas. And it is very difficult for us and probably many others across the state to fill these boards with three members. Right? I think out of all of them in the Mat-Su borough right now, we only have one that we're able to actually expand to five, and many of the three don't have them. And so when we get into a situation in a bad, bad winter storm, or even a bad summertime storm with like flooding and different things, drainage issues, roads washing out, if there's only two members on the board, or even if there's three and you filled it all out, they can't drive to the site. If one's already at the site during an emergency and another one gets there, they have to leave. They can't communicate in any way, shape, or form. Many of these board members, most of them are industry experts. They're in many cases understand our roads, in most cases I would say, understand our roads substantially better than our assembly members. And so we lean on them for their expertise. It's not to say that they get to take a vote or make decisions on budgets or anything like that, but we lean on them for their expertise. And it's put us in a real pickle a couple different times when we're trying to have on-site meetings, assembly member in the district come and maybe other assembly members, the borough manager, whoever it may be, and we can't get our area experts there together to try to figure out what to do. And so it was in conversation with our legal department at the Mat-Su borough that I had taken this into consideration. It's just, it's tough. You know, we don't have the OMA here, right? We can all meet together. And so, thanks for giving a consideration, and I'm open to any suggestions or ideas that you may have to make it better.
Thank you. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Yent, for being here. I have a question for you and another question for Director Moeller, who I believe is online. My first question is just on page 1, line 13, this changing from upon to on. What is the legal effect of that? I don't understand. Page 1, line 13.
That is through the chair, Senator Yount, for the record. I am not a legal scholar, so I would like to get some help with that one, please.
We will have you look to Ledge Legal and come back to the committee with an answer.
I'd like to phone a friend on that one.
I suspect it's just a cleanup. In my mind, it doesn't make any legal difference, but I want to make sure it doesn't before we pass the bill. Okay. My other question is for Director Moeller. So my question is about limited road service areas in Anchorage. We have a number of them, and they are not quite as rural as some of the places that Senator Yount is describing. And they can get pretty controversial and public because they manage quite a lot of money in some cases. And so I'm wondering, first of all, are limited road service areas, are they part of subsection 8, meetings of municipal service area boards? Does that include limited road service areas? And if it does, sort of what are the public protections? How can the public have transparency into the operations of some of those LRSAs in Anchorage?
Ms. Moeller.
Yeah, hello. For the record, this is Sandra Moeller, Director of DCRA, to the Chair and to Senator Dunbar. That's a very good question. We do support having as much local participation. The previous amendments that allowed for having road service areas talking about non-financial items was passed previously, and that was fine. I think by doing this bill, it does limit the amount, the ability primarily in the noticing of meetings, and therefore if there was notice provided in advance, that's really the Open Meetings Act and being able to have transparent discussion, this bill would in fact limit that ability.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Senator Dunbar.
Well, thank you for that, Director Mohler. And I didn't ask that question with the intent of submarining this bill. I think that the senator from Wasilla is trying to do something useful here for his community. But I also am trying to think about ways that we could, and not all LRSAs are the same either. And I don't know if SBIRSA, if that is, I'm sorry, that's the Chugiak Eagle River, if that falls under this as well. If it does, then, I mean, SBIRSA is a very important organization, as our chair well knows. And if they stop providing public notice, I think there would be a rebellion. What is there any way to distinguish those kind of LRSAs from the municipal boards that the senator from Wasilla is describing? Or is there any way to preserve some of the public notice requirements without imposing the more onerous parts of the Open Meetings Act that could prevent, that could sort of cause some of the problems that Senator Yunt is describing?
Ms. Mohler.
Yeah, to the chair again, Sandra Mohler, Director of Division of Community Regional Affairs. And to the question, I believe each of the road service areas and other municipally chartered organizations would be able to address their specific RSAs and different boards in a specific way. So if there's a municipality that wants to, in the example you stated, wanted to require that public notice was still provided, I believe that would still be allowable by the municipality.
That's a good point, Madam Chair, if I might.
Yes.
That's a good point. So even if we did this and remove the state requirement, the municipalities themselves could still impose their own version of the Open Meetings Act, for example, on a relatively large organization like SBIRSA. Is that what you're saying, Director Mohler?
To the chair, yes.
Okay. That's fair. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Yunt.
Thank you. For the record, Senator Yunt from Wasilla. I may add, too, I don't want to get away from, my intention is not to get away from public noticing at all. And the issue is you can't public notice in time for an emergency when you have an actual bad issue happening in your community. And so it could be fire, it could be a wildfire, fire service area stuff. It could be drainage issues, flooding. I mean, there's a lot of things that could lead to this, major snowstorms. And so perhaps maybe a local government, if we run this correctly and get it over the finish line, maybe just give a local government the authority to maybe carve out situations like that. You know, maybe that would be the best way to handle it. And so I'm open to any ideas. It's just really hard on us, like I said, when we're having a major issue with our roads in the winter or the summer, and we can't get our area experts together. It's tough, you know. And I was on the assembly. What I know about roads is I drive down them, right? I'm not an engineer. I'm not a retired road maintenance guy. I've never ran a grader. We have a lot of experts that we lean on for help, and we can't even get them together for good advice sometimes in an emergency situation. So,
thank you, Senator Yunt. I see nothing further. We will set Senate Bill 153 aside for further consideration. This concludes our agenda for this afternoon. Our next meeting will be Thursday, March 26th at 1:30 p.m. Please stay tuned for the agenda for that meeting. With that, at 2:45 p.m., we are adjourned.